Director.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
After you've moved into your own permanent home, you'll enjoy mechanized servants. Until then, you can have a computerized dog. Rags!
Woof, woof, woof. Woof, woof, woof. Hello, I'm Rags. Woof, woof.
Is your house broken, or will you be leaving little batteries all over the floor?
Do we have an obligation to be moral? How do we even know what is right or wrong?
Do we really have free will, or are the choices we make the result of causes and effects beyond our control?
Is my mind or soul a separate thing from my body, or just a function or product of my brain?
Are these the type of questions that interest you? Do you want to develop your skills in reasoning? Then you should check out the courses in philosophy that are offered at Henry Ford College. Philosophy deals with big perennial questions, questions that keep cropping up each generation because they are too big for one person or generation to answer completely. It is a quest to find the fundamental truths about our lives and our world through critical thinking. Henry Ford College regularly offers the following courses:
Introduction to Philosophy,
Introduction to Logic,
History of Philosophy,
Ethics, and Eastern Philosophy.
These courses will help you earn your degree and will help shape your thought for the rest of your life. For more information about the philosophy courses at Henry Ford College, look online at hfcc.edu or contact Professor Ryan Scholler at rshowler@hfcc.edu.
One in three adults has prediabetes. One in three. That means it could be you, your football buddy, your football buddy, or you, your best man, your worst man, you, your dog walker, your cat jogger. While one in three adults has prediabetes, with early diagnosis, prediabetes can be reversed. Take the risk test at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Find Highway 61, what you gotta do every Friday for the best in blues. 2 p.m. until 4 p.m. if you would please set your radio on FM 89.3. Detroit Blues and Best New Blues Friday 2 p.m. Streaming live at WHFR.FM. Henry Ford College Podcast is where to be. Friday 2 p.m. WHFR.FM 89.3. So now you know where to go and where to be. And join the blues and having some fun making waves with DJ Kitty Love. Find Highway 61, what you gotta do. Every Friday for the best in blues.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
I just start right at the top and fire some people.
The best politician of all is Nixon. But boy, when you get in tight and close and he's under attack...
President Nixon heard today the voice of the campus in a massive appeal for peace.
He's known as the madman theory. Make those North Vietnamese think that he was just crazy.
I'm Kurt Anderson. I've written books about the 1960s and 70s. I grew up back then. So I thought I knew the story of Richard Nixon's downfall. Watergate burglary, criminal cover-up, investigation, resignation, the end. But now, after digging deep into this history for a 7-part podcast about Nixon and the Vietnam War, I've come to a whole new understanding of Watergate. How it didn't just happen in isolation, but grew directly out of the war. I'll tell that story over the next hour, right after this.
Hey, hey, this is the Gothicbilly Man, your friendly neighborhood beatnik, inviting you to join me for the Wrecking Hours, Psychobilly Surf Rock and Rockabilly radio program. Tune in every Monday, 6 to 8 p.m. on 89.3 FM in Detroit, WHFR.FM online. It's the station making waves, WHFR Dearborn.
Seymour Hersh reported on all the president's men in the 1960s and 70s, knew a lot of them personally. And as he told me,
it was very hard to tell Nixon something he didn't want to hear.
But sometimes you had to. Like in 1973, at the beginning of his second term, just after the Ides of March, when White House counsel John Dean spent more than an hour in the Oval Office delivering a very grim diagnosis to the president.
The reason I thought we ought to talk this morning is because I have the impression that you don't know everything I know. And I think that there's no doubt about the seriousness of the problem we've got.
The problem is Watergate, of course. The Nixon team's burglary and attempted bugging of Democratic National Headquarters in Washington 9 months earlier, and the administration's cover-up of its involvement ever since.
We have a cancer close to the presidency that's growing. It's growing daily. It grows geometrically now because it compounds itself.
The cancer, the metastasizing web of crimes and lies that the press had gradually exposed and Justice Department prosecutors and Congress had now started looking at closely.
So let me give you the sort of basic facts. First of all, how did it all start? It started with instructions to see if we couldn't set up a perfectly legitimate campaign intelligence operation over at the Re-Election Committee.
Perfectly legitimate. In just a couple of weeks, Dean would start cooperating with the prosecutors. And eventually, he and dozens of administration accomplices would go to prison. 500 days from now, Watergate would force the president to resign.
Mr. Nixon's own leadership has failed. And tonight, 2 hours from now, he's going on television reportedly to tell the nation that he is quitting, the ultimate victim of the Watergate scandal that destroyed his administration.
This famous dramatic cancer within the presidency conversation reinforces the conventional wisdom about Nixon, that his self-destruction began with those famous crimes in 1972 and 73, and that Watergate was a self-contained piece of the Nixon story, separate from the Vietnam War. When we started on our podcast 2 years ago, that was my basic take. But now I've got a different understanding. Nixon took his first big step down the slippery slope of treachery and suspicion and secrecy and lies that led to his downfall before he was even elected president. And that step and the next up through Watergate were all rooted in the Vietnam War. Over the next hour, a look at how those two big threads of the Nixon presidency, Watergate and the war, we're deeply intertwined from beginning to end. I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Nixon at War.
My God, I would never do anything to encourage Trigonans off the table because basically that was what you got out of your bombing boys.
That's Republican candidate Nixon in 1968 assuring President Johnson that he would never, ever do anything to mess up the Vietnam peace talks at that delicate, critical moment.
Good God, we want them over in Paris. We've got to get them to Paris or you can't have a peace.
He was lying. Upon Nixon's instructions, his campaign finance official and intermediary Anna Chenault secretly, repeatedly passed instructions to South Vietnam's regime. Hang back, postpone the big peace breakthrough, help elect Nixon, and you'll get a better deal for yourselves. That intervention, temporarily monkey-wrenching the peace talks, was the original crime in his eventual presidential spree. It was his Watergate crimes in 72 and 73 that finally forced him to resign, but his biographer John Farrell thinks those dirty tricks in 1968 to become president were morally worse.
I believe that Nixon's actions in the fall of 1968 were the most reprehensible of his presidency.
Remarkably, his secret scheme worked, may have clinched him the election. Even more remarkably, his denial and cover-up of the scheme worked for decades. As president, Nixon had his aide, Tom Charles Houston, investigate, and Houston concluded that Nixon had gotten away with it.
What I was able to tell him was that based on what I had seen, Johnson was never able to establish with any certainty that Nixon had personally any role whatsoever in that.
And so Nixon stuck to his story.
I had no knowledge of any contact with the South Vietnamese.
This is 3 years after he left office in his famous TV interview series with David Frost.
I couldn't have done that in good conscience.
A lie. But
as far as he knew, there was no trace of his personal involvement. Despite that, he fought very hard for years and successfully for years until his death to keep his political and personal papers and the vast majority of the White House tapes away from the public,
including records of his Vietnam meddling as a presidential candidate that his predecessor, Lyndon Johnson, got from the FBI and NSA and CIA surveillance in real time, which LBJ's aides like Tom Johnson called the X-File.
Is the X-File, the Chenault documents, part of what he's worried about?
Oh, it had to be. If this story had come out, I mean, this was huge front page news. If I were Richard Nixon, I'd be very, very worried about it, even being disclosed during his presidency. Look, this was treason. You can shape it any way you'd like to shape it, but this was treason. And it was directed by the candidate, Richard Nixon, who became president of the United States.
Something else I've learned, the extent to which the Nixon campaign and then the Nixon White House was about spying and concealment, unearthing and keeping secrets, for which Nixon really had the perfect co-conspirator in Henry Kissinger, a Harvard professor who used his connections to the U.S. peace negotiators to get intel to help Nixon win in 1968 in order to get hired as the new president's national security advisor.
You know, Kissinger was a Shakespearean diabolical character.
Seymour Hersh knew Kissinger for a half century and wrote a book about him.
He never had any guilt about anything. He just did it.
One thing that the two of them really have in common is this just intense desire for secrets, right? That's a big thing for both of them.
Oh, my God. Totally. Totally. And Nixon was a paranoid. I mean, there's no other question about it. And Henry, in his way, was a paranoid. You know, you had to hide what you were doing. Everybody was told a different story in the government. And that's why people were spying.
Including on their own colleagues.
Remember the White House spying stuff? They were spying because everybody knew there was more going on than he was saying.
Kissinger's special assistant, Winston Lord, was specifically assigned to keep track of his boss's various lies and dissembling.
Kissinger couldn't quite remember who knew what. So Lord's job, it sounds crazy. One of his jobs, he had a substantive job too, was to say, remember, Henry, when you see him, he doesn't know about these talks and this talk.
In fact, it was Kissinger's dissembling and Nixon's spiraling mistrust that led the president to start bugging himself in the White House. The voice-activated tape system, his speechwriter William Safire later called the monster with total recall.
He became bothered by the winter of 1971 when he heard that Kissinger was going around town talking about how great Kissinger was and how bad Nixon was.
Evan Thomas interviewed Kissinger for his Nixon biography.
It was upsetting to the president, so he put in a taping system so that when he, Nixon, wrote his memoirs, there would be a record, a taped record, of who really had done what.
Kissinger also secretly recorded his own phone conversations, but unlike his boss, he had the audio transcribed, but the tapes destroyed.
Nixon saw that Kissinger was, like him, a manipulative, secretive bastard, and that they got along. It was a kind of a love-hate relationship because each was trying to manipulate the other and didn't really trust each other. So they were kindred souls, and they could make music together, the music of lies. But they saw eye to eye on the need to be manipulative and cunning, even as they were manipulating each other.
In June 1971, Nixon and Kissinger were seeing eye to eye on Vietnam, and Vietnamization appeared to be working, at least in America, politically.
I can assure you tonight, with confidence, that American involvement in this war is coming to an end.
Troop withdrawals proceeding apace. American deaths coming down, the year's big anti-war protests all done, and Congress still neglecting to impose any fixed deadline for ending the war. But then on June 13th, the Sunday morning after his daughter Trisha's fabulous White House wedding, the Pentagon Papers begin appearing in the New York Times. A massive scoop. As his military aide Al Haig puts it,
this goddamn New York Times expose of the most highly classified documents of the war.
And soon, things start to fall apart. The Pentagon Papers contain nothing about Nixon's Vietnam War, but he still regards them as a shot across his bow by his enemies, the press, the liberals, the elites. As he tells Kissinger later that day,
the thing, though, that Henry, that to me is just unconscionable, this is treasonable action on the part of the bastards that put it out.
Treasonable. Treason was the very word LBJ had used to describe candidate Nixon's unauthorized Vietnam shenanigans 3 years before.
People have got to be put to the torch for this sort of thing. This is terrible.
Track the bastards down. Put them to the torch.
The Pentagon Papers came out in the Sunday New York Times.
39-year-old Chuck Colson, one of the hardcore SOBs in Nixon's White House, became a leader of this hunt. The next morning,
I was at the senior staff meeting in the Roosevelt Room, and there was a mood of panic and despair. Kissinger throwing papers on the table saying, we cannot run a government this way. I was in with Nixon that morning, and he was genuinely alarmed. I mean, I could tell when Nixon was putting on an act. I could tell when Nixon was manipulating people. I'd been with him enough that I knew when he was doing things for effect. He wasn't doing this for effect. He was genuinely concerned.
That night, eating dinner alone in his office, Nixon takes a call from his de facto deputy chief of staff about the Pentagon Papers.
It's Mr. Ehrlichman calling you, sir.
Yeah.
John Ehrlichman, phoning about John Mitchell, the tough lawyer who'd run the 1968 campaign and now runs the Justice Department. Mitchell wants to prevent any more of the Pentagon Papers from being published by getting a court to impose prior restraint, censor the Times.
Mr. President, the Attorney General's called a couple times about these New York Times stories, and he's advised by his people that unless he puts the Times on notice, he's probably going to waive any right of prosecution against the newspaper. And he is calling now to see if you would approve his putting them on notice before their first edition for tomorrow comes out.
You mean to prosecute the Times?
Right.
Hell, I wouldn't prosecute the Times. My view is to prosecute the goddamn that gave it to him.
Yeah.
This is key for Nixon. He wants to nail the snitch. In the Oval Office that day, General Haig reports he's already on the trail. Walt Rostow is Kissinger's predecessor. Dan Ellsberg, who morphed from gung-ho hawk to crusading dove. Nixon had never heard of Ellsberg. But Kissinger, who knew him well, once said he had learned more about Vietnam from him than from any other American.
I had been a consultant to Henry Kissinger, first in the Hotel Pierre when the transition team was working, and then in his office, in the executive office building. I had worked on alternative options in Vietnam, trying to cost them out in a rough way and to say the pros and cons and the possible consequences.
6 months after that gig with Kissinger ended, Ellsberg started photocopying the classified history of the war that he'd helped write. And in early 1971, started showing those documents to a New York Times reporter he'd met in Vietnam.
Neil Sheehan, in urging me not to give it to a congressman first, but to let the Times do it, I was skeptical about it. I thought, well, they just want a Pulitzer Prize. I didn't really think that was the way to do it. But he was right.
Sheehan secretly made a copy of Ellsberg's purloined first copy of the Pentagon Papers without telling him. And soon, there they were, page one of the New York Times. Twenty-four hours later, the president was giving Chuck Colson orders.
He was genuinely concerned that there could be a wholesale breakdown in our security system and we would get CIA assets exposed, we would get secret operations out into public domain, and this could be catastrophic to us. So he was aware of the consequences more than anybody else, more than Kissinger, I think, and told me to do whatever it took. And that really led to the creation of the Plumbers, guys running off with reckless abandon.
The Plumbers.
the extra legal team with the cute name because they were supposed to find and fix leaks.
And that was really the trigger for what later became the undoing of the Nixon presidency.
In other words, summer of 1971 is when Richard Nixon really goes off the rails. I'm Kurt Anderson. We'll be right back with Nixon at War from PRX.
Do you like the sound of a jazzy big band? How about something operatic? Maybe something lighthearted.
I'm feeling too good today. I'm feeling the way I shouldn't. I'm feeling too good today.
Hear them all on Big Band Broadway and Beyond. I'm Joe, your host, every Friday from 10 a.m. till noon on WHFR 89.3.
Powerful threat calls for a greater response.
When there's a battle, bring strength.
When there's a problem, seek answers.
When there is doubt, give hope.
Not tomorrow.
Not in a few years.
But right now.
Some battles must be faced together. Cancer fighters stand up to cancer every day. And you can be part of this battle too.
Visit standuptocancer.org to learn more.
Together, we can save lives.
Green jobs are here to stay. Why not go green with a degree in alternative energy here at Henry Ford College? Students will acquire knowledge in advanced fuel sources and the practice of alternative energy in the world. For more information on the alternative energy program, please contact HFC's Technology Division by calling 313-317-9816 or by going to hfcc.edu/programs.
I want to know who did this. Now, goddammit, I want to find out. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
Okay, let's go.
The president had always liked the tough talk of his aides like Colson, but now he ordered them to start executing special ops. They set up shop next door to the White House West Wing. And it's not just the plumbers. Over those next few weeks, Nixon and his men launched a multi-front secret domestic war. Some of the operations illegal, some just wrong, all directed at the conspiracy of enemies, the liberals, the Democrats, what was not yet known as the deep state, and the press. Antagonism to the press was always central to the Nixon brand. In 1968, the interviewer David Frost asked him if there's any one thing he'd ever said that he regrets.
Many people looking at my life would say that the statement that I should not have made was my criticism of the press when I lost for governor of California.
6 years before, his legendary press conference in Beverly Hills.
You've had an opportunity to attack me, and as I leave you, I want you to know, just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
So then, with Frost in 68, he had to explain himself.
As a public figure, I would say that was a mistake. And I can also assure you that as far as getting in an argument with the press, it won't happen again.
But now it was happening again, big time. The day after the Pentagon Papers start appearing, his attorney general telexes the Times publisher, telling him they're violating the espionage law. But it wouldn't just be that historic fight in the courts.
Yes, sir, Mr. President.
That night, Nixon phones Chuck Colson.
I was thinking on this New York Times thing. It's very important to
still to backfire on these people. Understand, we cast this in the right direction, Chuck. This could backfire on the Times. I mean, how the hell can a president or a secretary of defense or anybody do anything if it's going to be taken out in the trunk and given to a goddamn newspaper? The main thing is to cast it in terms of doing something disloyal to the country.
That's right.
This risks our men, you know, secret things that aid and comfort to the enemy.
To be clear, aid and comfort to the enemy, not by jeopardizing any military operations, but by revealing to the American people the government's years of falsehoods underpinning the whole war.
They're running the line, Chuck, of right to know. That's, of course, a goddamn code word, right to know. The public has no right to know secret documents.
No, of course not.
And freedom of the press is not the freedom to destroy the integrity of the government. What the Times has done is placed itself above the law. They say, we consider this an immoral war. It's our responsibility to print it. Now, goddammit, you can't have that thing in a free country.
And now, the stuff of movies. An appeals court grants the Nixon Justice Department an injunction that stops the Times from publishing more Pentagon papers. But by Friday, the Washington Post is already publishing its own articles, with a green light from a different federal court to keep going. Newspapers around the country start republishing the articles as well. As far as Nixon is concerned, his darkest fears and hatred of the press and the liberals' anti-Nixon conspiracy are coming true. He phones J. Edgar Hoover, an ally for a quarter century. The FBI director brings up the Post and its owner and publisher, Katharine Graham.
I saw her on the TV last night, Mrs. Graham. I would have thought she's about 85 years old. She's only about, I think, something like 57.
She had just turned 54.
She's a terrible old bag.
Oh, she's an old bitch in my estimation.
That's right.
I don't think you should say anything. It's the very thing that the enemies of the administration want to do, is to divert the attack upon you.
The enemies of the administration, such as Democratic leaders, present and past.
No, actually, the stories in the Post and Times this morning were all about Kennedy and DM.
Kennedy, he was the one who started it, and then Lyndon Johnson escalated it, and then you inherited it, and you have brought it down. You never sent an additional man in there.
Nixon had made this same point to Colson.
Now, we've got to get across several points. One, it's the Kennedy-Johnson papers, basically. That's what we're talking about, the Kennedy-Johnson papers, and that gets it out of our way.
In fact, even as he begins his righteous crusade to keep government secrets secret, he's ordering his own men to dig up more classified dirt on the last two presidents' national security operations, and then to leak that material to the despicable press.
Tuesday, June 22nd, the New York Times papers question goes on.
White House Chief of Staff Bob Haldeman in his diary that night.
President now wants to set up a small team to start rifling through all the secret documents, especially the Cuban Missile Crisis, etc., as well as Vietnam, and then get some newspapers to demand that it come out.
During the Pentagon Papers frenzy, Chuck Colson and John Dean start crafting a whole plan, quote, to screw our political enemies using the available federal machinery, not just the IRS, and catalog targets, the infamous enemies list, eventually hundreds of names. Then there's the new superstar dove Nixon once shot down, Daniel Ellsberg. Just 2 days after the first Pentagon Papers articles, talking to Colson, Nixon applies an old template to the affair.
That was really what Alger Hiss did, you said.
That's right.
Alger Hiss, Nixon's original lefty nemesis. He was a former communist and former U.S. diplomat accused in 1948 of having slipped information to the Soviets in the 1930s.
He put himself on a higher pedestal and said, well, the Russians are entitled to know this. And he passed the information. And the New York Times assembly was among the papers that supported him.
As a freshman member of the House Un-American Activities Committee at the very start of the Cold War, Congressman Nixon fixated on Hiss.
Hiss was popular. The committee was unpopular. And the administration and the media were lined up against us.
20 years later, in his final memoir, he was still bragging.
The Hiss case made me a major national figure. By going forward with the investigation, I risked everything. In the Hiss case, my risk paid off.
And now, still, in 1971, with a shooting war against communists and now the Pentagon Papers.
Sunday, June 20th at Key Biscayne, President, explain to me that in order to understand this whole thing, we have to understand the Hiss case, that they're very similar, although none of us really realizes it.
In fact, not very similar. Very different.
Ellsberg shared his classified historical documents with American reporters and the whole world.
These papers are not what are important in themselves. We've got to get Ellsberg nailed hard on the basis of being guilty of stealing the papers.
Nixon's real goal here is to nail Ellsberg in order to nail the press, as he actually told David Frost a few years later.
It is an immoral, during a campaign, to fight back, to keep a prejudiced press from cutting your guts out. That's moral. It's immoral not to fight.
To Nixon, the liberal deep state out to get him was now embodied by Dan Ellsberg, just a new iteration of the Pinko Alger Hiss, conspiring with the Nixon-hating press and the whole elite establishment. And soon?
Tuesday, June 29th. Today started with the 8 o'clock cabinet meeting at which the president delivered his blast to the cabinet.
Nixon tied it all together in a kind of mad aria.
The president did all the talking.
Haldeman reading the transcript.
Down in the government are a bunch of sons of bitches. We have yet to fire one of these people. We've checked and found that 96% of the bureaucracy are against us. They're bastards who are here to screw us. Beneath you, you have a whole department full of vipers, and they'll strike because they want to beat us, especially next year. Ellsberg has gone out and said he's not guilty because what he did for the sake of the country. Hiss and the Rosenbergs and those people all said the same thing. We're going to go forward on Ellsberg and prosecute him. And then he just got up and walked out. That was the end of the meeting. It was pretty impressive.
Ellsberg has just turned himself in to federal authorities. The next day, Nixon is discussing him with Attorney General Mitchell and Kissinger. Let's get the son of a bitch into jail.
Leak it out. We want to destroy him in the press and declare.
Leak it out. We want to destroy him in the press.
Did you think you were going to go to jail?
Well, yeah.
Dan Ellsberg.
I thought if they prosecute, which is 97% likely, I'm bound to be convicted. 7,000 pages of top secret documents. As my lawyer said to me later, it has a bad ring to it. And moreover, 7,000 pages, I'll go for life. I thought this won't be a year or two or 5 years. So I expected to go to jail.
For life?
For life. Well, life, 30 years.
Hours after Nixon's rough, tough talk to his cabinet, he phones General Haig to start squeezing more of the liberal deep state establishment by canceling security clearances for the think tank RAND, where Ellsberg worked, and the Brookings Institution.
We've got a massive legal problem, sir. I've got all of the departments in there with me right now on this subject.
You have?
Yes, sir.
Good.
There are existing contracts, you see, that may have legal basis.
Brookings? Is Brookings out of contract?
They think Brookings does.
Well, Brookings doesn't have any contracts that I ever approved. Now, goddammit, I want to know how that got by me, if they have one with Brookings. Now, I really want to know.
All right, sir.
If it was done in this administration, I want to know why. I want to know who signed it, who approved it, okay?
All right, sir. Fine.
On Brookings, because I gave specific orders in January of 1969 not to do anything to Brookings.
Nixon had turned the Pentagon Papers into the great modern test of the limits of a free press. And for the last 2 weeks of June, America anxiously waited for the Supreme Court to decide.
Wednesday, June 30th, we had the court decision this afternoon. Court went 6-3 against us.
That is, for the newspapers and a free press. Times publisher Arthur Sulzberger that day.
My reaction was very simply one of joy, one of delight, and now we'll go back to business as normal.
Nixon had lost this battle, but not the war. Next day, he phones the FBI director.
Edgar, I wanted to tell you that I was so damn mad when that Supreme Court had to come down. First, I didn't like their decision, but
I didn't either.
Unbelievable, wasn't it?
It was unbelievable.
You know, those clowns we got on there, I'll tell you, I hope I outlive the bastards.
In fact, two of the three Supreme Court dissenters in the Pentagon Papers case were the two justices Nixon had appointed. The FBI director also gives the president advice on the leaker and the FBI's evidence against him.
I think we ought to be awful careful what we do in this case of this man Ellsberg.
Because there again, they're going to make a martyr out of him. I mean, view what the Supreme Court has now said, I doubt whether we're going to be able to get a conviction of him.
Mm-hmm.
I hope so, but I doubt it. We've got a good, strong case on him.
Mm-hmm.
His first wife testified very vigorously against him. And it's a good, strong case. But
I'd like to check some of the other people around him. That's the others. I think there's a conspiracy involved.
And Hoover proceeds to name some reporters in on the conspiracy. Of course, he and Nixon had been through this together before, on the Alger Hiss case. That same day, just ahead of the 1971 July 4th weekend, Nixon instructs Haldeman to start leaking about Ellsberg and other liberals, as he kept reminding everyone around him he'd successfully done with Alger Hiss. Just an hour later, he's back with Haldeman, repeating the order, start our black ops now. We're going to use any means.
Nixon had for a long time wanted to ramp up spying on his foes.
Nixon biographer Evan Thomas.
Normally, you would do that through J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. But by 1971, Hoover, who was a smart politician, decided to get the FBI out of the black bag break-in and spying business. So Hoover refused to be Nixon's spy.
Which brings us back to where we started, with the secret X-file from 1968 that so obsessed Richard Nixon.
Did they get the Brookings Institute ready last night? Get it done. I want it done. I want the Brookings Institute to say, clean out.
It's one of the most remarkable moments on Nixon's tapes.
Nixon historian Ken Hughes has spent years at the University of Virginia's Miller Center of Public Affairs sifting through the White House recordings.
It's the only time that the president recorded himself ordering a break-in. He actually orders his aides to break into the Brookings Institution, crack open the safe, and steal the report. And he's dead serious.
Chuck Colson describes how one of their special ops guys, an ex-cop, suggested some extreme tradecraft for that heist.
He said, you know, I was with the New York police. We used to create a fire as a diversion, and then we'd go in and get any papers we wanted out of anybody's office. I said, I don't know how you do your business, but all I can tell you is the president wants those papers back.
Arson as well as burglary? If that's what it takes. What did Nixon think was worth all this? His aide, Tom Charles Houston.
I did a separate report to the president on what had happened in this, you know, the surveillance.
Note, 40 years later, he still stops himself from saying the Chenault surveillance.
What did they know, you know, as to how extensive the campaign's involvement had been in trying to influence President Chu's decision not to go to the Paris talks?
On assignment from the president, Houston had visited the Pentagon guy in charge of any files about this, who said they no longer had a copy, but that the Brookings Institution apparently did. And back at the White House, Houston talked to Haldeman and his other colleagues.
And I said, well, now, what about Brookings? I said, you know, it seems to me they have no business having that, and they're not up to any good over there, and we ought to just go get it and tell them to give it back.
So the black ops guys cased the joint a mile from the White House, walked into Brookings one evening that summer, told a guard they were headed to the fifth floor to visit a senior fellow, Mort Halperin, Kissinger's former aide, Ellsberg's friend.
Somehow the Nixon White House, we now know, became convinced that the Pentagon Papers were at Brookings, and so were lots of other secret documents about Vietnam. But none of it was true. Brookings had no storage for classified information and no secret documents of any kind.
The guard turned away the White House goons. That heist never happened. But the mysterious damning secret file was not an imaginary Maltese Falcon. It existed. And on it, somebody had written the X envelope. When LBJ left the White House, it went with him to Texas, along with his aide, Tom Johnson, who says that the ex-president
continued to keep it secret. He put it in an envelope, or they put it all into an X file or an X letter, and didn't give it to me. He gave it to Walt Rostow, who was there.
Down in Austin,
teaching at the university, ghostwriting LBJ's memoir, and sitting on the X-File, which President Nixon, back at the White House, was still obsessing about.
I'm Kurt Anderson. We'll be right back with Nixon at War from PRX and the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Henry Ford College in Dearborn, Michigan is a comprehensive public college serving about 18,000 students each year in Southeast Michigan. HFC is dedicated to preparing students for the rapidly changing workplace in today's world by offering more than 100 associate degree and university transfer programs. HFC also specializes in customized workforce development training for business and industry. Since its founding in 1938, HFC has been the gateway to higher education for thousands of students who seek an affordable, high-quality post-secondary education. To learn more about what HFC has to offer, please visit us at www.hfcc.edu or you can call the campus office at 1-800-585-HFCC. Your future begins now, and it begins right here at Henry Ford College.
Crew, let's get her dug.
Honey, you want to give me a hand? I'm planting that tree, remember?
No matter how large or small your digging project may be, no matter how urban or rural, you must always call 811 before any digging project. 811 is our national one-call number, alerting your local utility companies to come out and mark any lines they have near your dig site. You must call 811 at least 2 to 3 business days before any digging project so you can avoid hitting our essential buried utilities. This includes natural gas and petroleum pipelines, electric, communication cables, and water and sewer lines. So before you do this or this, make sure you do this. For digging projects big or small, make the call to 811. Brought to you by Common Ground Alliance.
In 1971, the war in Vietnam was still going on. But to Nixon and Kissinger, it was now a chronic annoyance that they were managing, finally offloading.
They saw Vietnam as an irrelevant backwater.
Nixon biographer John Farrell.
Not terribly important to any United States strategic interest, except for the fact that we had to get out with a modicum of respect, with some flags flying, with some prestige intact, so that we could continue to be a superpower elsewhere around the globe.
I think what drove Nixon mad that summer was this. That receding backwater war had suddenly been whipped into an 11th-hour front-page problem by the liberal elite. And just as he was going to grab the brass ring.
The greatest honor history can bestow is the title of peacemaker.
And it really was about to be bestowed on him. All that spring, Mr. Anti-Communist Leader of the Free World had been working to create a normal relationship with big, scary, nuclear missile-armed communist China, working secretly, and in this case, justifiably so. Mao Zedong and Premier Zhou Enlai had finally said okay, and in July, a week after Kissinger secretly met with Zhou,
I have requested this television time tonight to announce a major development in our efforts to build a lasting peace in the world. The meeting between the leaders of China and the United States is to seek the normalization of relations between the two countries. It is in this spirit that I will undertake what I deeply hope will become a journey for peace, not just for our generation, but for future generations on this earth we share together.
A bona fide historic breakthrough. And U.S. military forces were continuing to leave Southeast Asia right on track. And so by the fall, with his re-election campaign about to start, Nixon had pulled ahead of the presumed Democratic front-runners in the polls. But his domestic special ops Cold War that grew out of the Vietnam War against his American opponents kept escalating. Late that summer, Nixon's aide Bud Krogh gave the green light to the plumber's first completed burglary. Friday of Labor Day weekend, his gang broke into the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychoanalyst.
Here's what I now understand happened.
Dan Ellsberg.
Nixon, pursuing a policy which involved the possibility of continuing to escalate the war, possibly even using nuclear weapons, had to shut me up and keep me from revealing documents that I might still have, or he assumed I probably did have, that would reveal his planning going back to 69. So basically, the first step they took there was to try to get information from my former psychoanalyst's office that I would not want out, to threaten me with being put out if I didn't cooperate by shutting up. A psychoanalyst's office seemed to be a logical place to do that. They didn't find information there that they could blackmail me with, but it was a good try.
Nixon told David Frost he didn't know about that burglary beforehand, but if they had asked his permission?
I would have said, go right ahead. Call it paranoia, but paranoia for peace isn't that bad. Basically, what Ellsberg really boils down to, I didn't want to discredit the man as an individual. I couldn't care less about the punk. I wanted to discredit that kind of activity, which was despicable and damaging to the national interest.
Nixon was not terribly reckless to believe that he could commit crimes like this and keep them quiet. Presidents did this kind of thing all the time, and nearly all of them they kept quiet. So he wasn't unusually reckless in doing this. He had bad luck. But he was vulnerable. There was a possibility, and he took that risk to preserve a Vietnam policy that he thought would work foolishly, but not impossibly. He was wrong.
Plotting and executing burglaries, abusing government power, paranoia run amok. But publicly, as 1971 turned to 1972, everything looked swell for Nixon, especially his week in China, at the center of the world's attention, meeting for hours with the leaders, his historic photo op with Chairman Mao.
East meets West as a handshake bridges 16,000 miles and 22 years of hostility. At the summit, face to face, two leaders who direct the destiny of one out of three persons on the earth. The gate to friendly contact has finally been opened.
In 1972, I turned 18, registered for the draft, and, thanks to the new 26th Amendment, registered to vote and volunteered in the campaign of the Democrats' peacenik nominee, George McGovern, which made it kind of funny when I got a letter from President Nixon naming me a 1972 presidential scholar, one of 120 graduating high school seniors invited to the White House in June to receive a medal with his signature. For the rest of the world, there was a more memorable White House-related event that week.
We have a mystery story out of Washington. Five people have been arrested and charged with breaking into the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee in the middle of the night.
The Democratic National Committee is located in the Watergate office building. The burglars forced a stairwell door, then taped its latch open. The door now...
They were there to bug the phones. Among the Watergate burglars were the same guys who'd broken into Ellsberg's psychoanalyst's office the year before. But the world didn't know that yet. And through the remainder of the election year, the White House cover-up worked. Watergate would not become Nixon's existential problem for many months. And at the end of October 1972...
We believe that peace is at hand.
A sudden, breathless Kissinger White House press conference. TV news special reports, huge front page banner headlines, a big successful October surprise, and about peace in Vietnam, like in that last presidential election.
We believe that an agreement is within sight, and having come this far, we cannot fail, and we will not fail.
11 days later...
We have accomplished what was thought to be the impossible. We've not only won a majority of the votes of America, but we've won a majority of the votes of young America.
Nixon had squeaked by in 1968, but now he was reelected in a massive landslide, winning 49 of 50 states. I'd started college that fall. It felt as if they'd ended the revolution without me.
Was it your sense as a journalist that as a story, the Vietnam War was sort of receding?
Not for me, but it was.
Cy Hirsch had just become a star reporter at the New York Times, thanks to his Pulitzer Prize reporting on Vietnam.
I joined the Times to do Vietnam, and I was sent there to make whoopee on the war. And within 4 or 5 months, they demanded I leave, and I was put into Watergate. They said, forget Vietnam right now. You know, you got to do this. And I was really shocked.
Americans were really eager, even desperate, to move on from Vietnam.
I realized then that there was a sense that we'd lost the war.
That whole January of 1973 is like some pre-finale montage. Daniel Ellsberg's federal espionage trial begins in L.A. Back in Washington, a second inaugural.
When we met here 4 years ago, America was bleak in spirit, depressed by the prospect of seemingly endless war abroad and of destructive conflict at home. As we meet here today, we stand on the threshold of a new era of peace in the world.
2 days later, Lyndon Johnson dies in Texas. His confidant down there, Walt Rostow, still has the X-file about Richard Nixon and Vietnam that LBJ had given him. And then, 3 days later in Paris...
Good evening. I have asked for this radio and television time tonight for the purpose of announcing that we today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam and in Southeast Asia. All the conditions that I laid down have been met. Within 60 days from this Saturday, all Americans held prisoners of war throughout Indochina will be released. All American forces will be withdrawn from South Vietnam.
In January, Nixon's Gallup approval hits its absolute peak, 68%. And on the separate question about Vietnam, 75% of Americans approve of how the president has done. But the week right after the peace treaty is signed, the first Watergate burglars are convicted, followed a week later by the formation of the Senate Watergate Committee. For the rest of 1973, the Nixon downfall proceeds. Dan Ellsberg's trial is stopped by the judge, all charges against him dismissed. The president's ex-speechwriter, William Safire, now a New York Times columnist, learns that he was bugged in the White House by, quote, Nixon or some lizard-lidded paranoid acting in his name. The president finally makes Kissinger Secretary of State, after which Kissinger, not Nixon, wins the Nobel Peace Prize for ending the Vietnam War. By the end of the year, Watergate has pushed the president's approval down toward 25%. Then, 1974, the end.
This lengthy standing ovation from members of the White House staff.
He's resigned, the only president ever to do so.
Never get discouraged. Never be petty. Always remember, others may hate you. But those who hate you don't win unless you hate them. And then you destroy yourself.
When I was growing up, my mom quoted one line to me dozens of times. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. It's from a Sir Walter Scott poem about the court of Henry VIII. I thought of it a lot as we made this series.
There's a direct line from Nixon's feeling of futility and misery about Vietnam to the Watergate break-in.
Biographer Evan Thomas.
Basically, Nixon's insanity about secrecy and his paranoia about his enemies first leads him to want to do illegal acts to protect himself on Vietnam, which directly leads to illegal acts to get himself reelected in 1972.
the abuses of power that he engaged in were linked to his support for that war and opposition to the opponents of the war. I mean, go to the enemies list. Most of the people on the enemies list were people who opposed the war.
Elizabeth Holtzman is really the anti-Nixon. The same day he was reelected, she became the youngest woman ever elected to Congress as an anti-Vietnam War candidate from Brooklyn, and promptly got on the House Judiciary Committee investigating Watergate, drafting impeachment articles.
Actually, you can trace the Watergate break-in to the Vietnam War itself and the bombing of Cambodia. A New York Times reporter broke a story that the U.S. was bombing in Cambodia. That infuriated Nixon, and he wanted to figure out how that reporter got the information. And that's when his surveillance program started, the illegal surveillance program. So that surveillance program, which was designed to stop leaks about the Vietnam War, was the key to Nixon's illegal surveillance, which is what the Watergate break-in was about. Illegal surveillance of the Democratic Party in order to win the election, his reelection effort. So, you know, it's a straight line. It's just a straight line.
And actually, except for the illegal part, the president himself more or less agreed.
My administration did have a carefully limited and totally legal policy of conducting wiretapping for reasons of national security. I do not at all regret having that policy. We were at war in Vietnam.
As a world historical event, Nixon and Kissinger were right. The Vietnam War was kind of minor league. Geopolitically, the war in Vietnam really only changed Vietnam. But the war had a huge impact on America, on Americans, our culture and psychology and politics in so many ways, then and now. A feeling of division that Richard Nixon exploited and exacerbated in order to get elected and reelected, as have his political descendants ever since. The lies and hubris and misguidedness of the Vietnam War profoundly undermined Americans' trust in government, which Nixon made worse by keeping the war going for years.
It's just this heedlessness about the human life at stake that I think is shocking.
John Farrell.
It makes it worse than just eavesdropping on your political opponent. The fate of the people of Southeast Asia just didn't really matter. The extra 25,000 Americans who died and the hundreds of thousands who were wounded in that time didn't matter as much as American prestige. Vietnam, his handling of Vietnam was much more dastardly and painful and underhanded as a whole than anything that happened with Watergate, which really Watergate was dirty political tricks carried to the next level.
No question more dastardly. His high crimes in America were bad. The additional death and destruction in Southeast Asia, worse. But here's what's also true. Nixon's collateral domestic Vietnam War, a president encouraging Americans to consider fellow citizens their enemies, and his gangsterism that grew out of the war, up to and including Watergate, together, combined, amounted to a horrible, synergistic 1-2 punch to America's gut, radically deepening our cynicism about government and each other, and undermining American solidarity for two generations and counting. I'm Kurt Anderson, and from PRX, this has been Nixon at War. Thanks very much for listening. I'm the writer and a co-producer. The senior producer is Emma Wetherill. The producer and researcher is Caitlin Raffi. And our mix engineer is Robin Wise. Our original music is by Mason Daring, with additional music by Tim Dickinson. The executive producer is Steve Atlas. For archival material in the series, our great thanks to the Richard Nixon Presidential Library in Yorba Linda, California, the LBJ Presidential Library in Austin, Texas, the Miller Center at the University of Virginia, Open Vault from GBH Archives, NixonTapes.org, and Rotunda, the digital imprint of the University of Virginia Press, for use of the presidential recordings. Finally, special thanks to Lucy Anderson, Chris Oppie, Heather Ash, Karen Cariani, Julia Chin, Wilfred Frost, Frank Gannon, Jocelyn Gonzalez, Mike Greco, Derek John, Susan Johnson, Monica Johnson, Frederick Logoval, Timothy Naftali, Luke Nichter, Ryan Pettigrew, Russell Riley, Mark Silverstone, Greg Smith, and Melinda Ward. And to our experts, John Farrell, Seymour Hirsch, Elizabeth Holtzman, Ken Hughes, Tom Johnson, and Evan Thomas.
If you found this hour interesting, I encourage you to check out our whole 7-episode podcast that we based it on, also called Nixon at War. You can find out more at nixonatwar.org or go ahead and subscribe to Nixon at War wherever you get podcasts.
Nixon at War has been made possible by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Democracy demands wisdom.
Hi, I'm Anderson Coleman, bringing you classic blues and R&B on 89.3 FM. Come and enjoy the renaissance of blues with a feeling Saturdays 8 to 10 p.m. on WHFR. You will hear great artists from B.B. King to ZZ Hill. It's a feel-good thing.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
That I know. It run from the twin.